you are stuck in a poorer neighborhood, you might be stuck in that property for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's a conspiracy with owners to want to keep people poor, but I do believe that there's always a segment of society that will be poor, and hence they have to live somewhere, and hence there will be investors willing to invest in those areas.
And welcome into Priced Out, the podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Morgan, and I'm right alongside Cornelius Swart. How you doing today, sir?
I am good, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good today, man. I cannot complain. We got a great interview. Rue is coming in for an interview today.
Rue Booty, yes. He is a real estate investment broker, and he's going to talk to us about the real estate game and how an investor sees the housing crisis. How someone who is essentially a middleman between someone who has a lot of money and wants to create a business called a multifamily property, an apartment building to you and me, and how and why they come about putting their money down in Portland and how that affects prices and how they see the residents of the city.
All right, let's go ahead and get into it.
Hi, folks. Welcome. We are here with Rue Booty, a Filipino-American real estate investment broker. Rue has been working here in Portland at firms such as North Stevens for the last couple of years. He was here during the housing crisis, and he understands how apartment buildings and condos get financed, how they get built, and why. And he's going to explain to us how the housing crisis happened from the perspective of real estate investment. He's just going to tell us sort of how the game is played, what happened in the financial system that influenced the mass evictions and massive construction that we've seen here in Portland. And that will also trickle down into, you know, what's happening in other cities, because it's going to be some pretty basic structural financial rules of the game that we'll talk about. And at the end, we'll also talk about a few pro tips about how folks should manage their money or could manage their money given, you know, the investment and real estate environment that we so many gentrifying cities see themselves in. So things like, when is it wise to rent and when is it wise to buy? Because it's not always, shouldn't always buy a house if you can. So great. So thanks so much for coming, Rue.
Well, Cornelius, thanks for having me.
What is an investment broker?
What I do is I help sellers find buyers for the property, and I do that in a way that we do the timing right so that we can defer certain taxes. Partly a tax game, but an investment property is essentially a business. So we have to look at it as a business. So we look at the numbers of a transaction to see if it works out for both sides.
Okay. And tell us a little bit more about just who you are. You moved here when you were 7 years old from the Philippines?
Yes. So there's six of us in our family. Wow. And we, four boys, my mom and dad, and we lived in the Philippines during the Marcos administration, and there was martial law at the time. And my parents are both professionals, so we were able to come into this country. And we did that in the early to mid 70s. And we saw that there was more opportunities here. And in fact, there is. My parents were able to buy their first property back in the 70s in Brooklyn, New York. It was a brownstone that already had a tenant.
Mm-hmm. And then, so you consider yourself, you kind of grew up, describe yourself as upper middle class.
Yeah, we like to think of ourselves as middle class. We know a lot of people a lot richer, and we know a lot of people a lot poorer. But I guess since my parents are professionals, I guess we can say we're upper middle class. But really, growing up, I thought we were poor.
Because you didn't have, like, the Nintendo system that you wanted, or... I grew up without cable. Everybody had cable. But, I mean, we were just generally comfortable, but my parents just wouldn't refuse to buy it.
But I don't want to date myself too much, but Nintendo system, we barely had Pong back then.
Oh, yeah, well, you're a little older. Okay.
So, yeah, but we did get the first Atari at one point.
Nice.
But my parents were always frugal, and I remember that I've once had pants that I knew were girl pants, but since they were on sale, I had to wear them. And, you know, little details like that that a kid notices, but hey.
How did you become a real estate investment broker?
Well, my family has always done real estate. So, again, we bought our first property back in the 70s in Brooklyn. And we saw that is essentially the way to the American dream, to basically own a part of America. So it's very important for us to own properties. And we've done a lot of different investments. For instance, when we were in college, my parents got us a property so that we could rent it out to our classmates. So essentially, they were paying for the mortgage, and we got to go to school almost for free.
Right, right.
So,
and as we discussed, and I've said before on other podcasts, you know, my family, my father was also in property management. He was also in property investment, multifamily property investments. His whole career. I am a partner in a commercial property. So I understand sort of the landlord perspective as well as covering the issue from every angle I possibly can. So that's something that we both share, and we talk about that during, you know, our other brief conversations.
Yes.
So when did you come out here to Portland, and when did you know, start focusing on what's going on out here?
Well, it's kind of funny that as a New Yorker, we don't really consider moving out to the West Coast very much. And my wife and I were sitting down at home one day. This is in Indiana, because we moved to Indiana. And one of our friends moved to Portland about a year before us. She moved out in 2014, around that time. And so she said, hey, why don't you come check it out? We weren't really considering moving here, but then we started watching shows like Portlandia, mm-hmm. and started mm-hmm. to hear that, yeah, Portlandia. We started to hear that the real estate market here is good. Mm-hmm. And so we started looking at different cities. We looked at New York, and we looked at Chicago. We had a place in Chicago, and we considered moving there full time. And we also looked at Portland, and when we did the math, we were priced out of New York City, my hometown. So, ironically, I moved into a neighborhood where I priced out, where other people are priced out, I guess.
And you're kind of my neighbor. You live about like 10 blocks away.
Yeah, so we live in Williams District, and we picked this area because it's growing. We know that it's gentrifying, so a lot of people who lived here for, I guess, generations are forced to move elsewhere. And I guess I don't feel too bad, because I too was priced out of my home state.
And around 2013, we start to see a lot of building here in Portland. Prices are really rising, you know, rents going up 15% a year or more. We're seeing whole buildings get evicted, and lots of buildings are being knocked down. What do you see? What was driving that?
What happened is that Oregon became more appealing to a lot of people, much in the same way that it did for my wife and me, because it's cheaper here. If you look at the average apartment in Portland when we moved in, it was around $1,300, maybe $1,325. Mm-hmm. But I remember in New York City, when I was there back in the 90s, my one-bedroom apartment was $2,100, and that was back then. So mm-hmm. it's still relatively cheaper here. By the way, I had two other roommates, so you know, for me it was $700. But mm-hmm. that was the only way that we could make it work in New York. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the cities that people want to move to, Portland is still one of the most affordable places.
The fact that Portland did not have a lot of restrictions on, didn't have a lot of renter protections. There was, you could evict someone in 30 days without cause. Was that driving some of the rent increases?
Well, I'm not sure that investors just looked at those rules and said, hey, this is a favorable spot for us. I think that they saw that Portland is pretty much undervalued compared to other cities. And even today, average rent is still lower. So I think that because of that, they felt that Portland is the way to go in a westward migration, although we're already in the West Coast. Mm-hmm.
So the ability to purchase a building and evict everyone and then bring it up market, you know, you see these jumps in value, you need to either acquire a building and increase the rent, or you need to buy a building, knock it down, and build something that is taking advantage of full pricing, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, obviously you don't want to be the bad guy and evict everyone from a building. I know that obviously there's new regulations to help families not get displaced. People go to school in certain areas and they want to stay there. So you don't want to do that. But the reality is that a lot of the buildings, like on Hawthorne, for instance, we've seen people who are still paying around $500 a month in rent there. Meanwhile, in that area for one bedroom, the market is probably closer to $1,300. Mm-hmm. So it's just undervalued. And that's why you were seeing a lot of tenants getting displaced, because they were just paying too low for their rent to begin with.
The rents jumped, and there were these mechanisms that allowed landlords to raise the rent overnight. You know, Star Management in 2015 recommended to its customers, its clients, the landlords, to raise the rents 30% on renewal. And because there was no restriction on that, you had the freedom to fully plumb the depths of the market, to find out what will the market bear.
The lack of regulation, I believe, is because there wasn't any need for it. But I guess at this point, a little bit of regulation could be good.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that as we get further in. So it seems like there was a lot of investment moving into Portland to capitalize on this spiraling rent. Did you see this kind of precipitous rise in rent, triple digit, you know, rent increases, you know, big returns on investment, big cap rates in other cities?
Our cap rates in Portland have declined. I think now it's around 5.3.
Explain what the cap rate is.
So basically a cap rate is a way to compare different properties. So if we're looking at multi-unit housing, although one could have many more units than another, we can compare that investment using a cap rate. And to boil it down, a 5 cap rate just means that for every $100 that you spend in a property, it returns $5 a year. Generally, the lower the cap rate, the nicer, newer, shinier the building. So it's in a more desirable spot. And the reason why you make less money from those buildings is because you essentially have less risk, since the demographics in that area would probably have better credit and so on.
Mm-hmm. So talking about cap rate, so to me, you want a high cap rate. That's your profitability, and the bigger the cap rate, the more money you're making. Just like you said, if you're investing a dollar, the higher the cap rate, the bigger the return on that dollar.
If you're the buyer, yeah. So yeah, cap rate, it depends on what side you're looking at. If you're selling a property, then you want a low cap rate because you're trying to sell it for more money. It has to do with the formula. So if you take the NOI for property, that's basically the income of the property minus
operating income.
Yeah, minus vacancy, minus expenses. If you take that and you divide it by a smaller number, then the value of the property is higher.
So, but you're saying that the cap rates, the profitability, the income that's coming out of that building is going to be higher in less desirable neighborhoods.
It is. I think that if you look at Gresham, for instance, you'll get the higher cap rates there. In Rockwood and so on. So you get the higher cap rates there. So you make more from your investment. However, there's greater risk. So the people there may not have the best credit. They might have lower paying jobs.
Higher turnover in the building. More people can't pay the rent and you have to, you know, their higher vacancy rate.
Maybe. Not necessarily, because turnover has to do a lot with the type of units there are. Mm-hmm. So a studio has high turnover, mm-hmm. but a two bedroom, one bath has lower turnover. Mm-hmm. And from my personal experience and the data that I've seen, turnover is not necessarily higher in poorer neighborhoods. In fact, I would argue that it's the opposite, mm-hmm. because in wealthier areas where you have a lot of young professionals, they have the ability to move to different buildings. They could buy houses. But if you are stuck in a poorer neighborhood, you might be stuck in that property for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So, what I find interesting is that in poorer neighborhoods, the properties are more profitable.
They're more
the owners.
Yes, of course.
Of course,
of
right.
Of course. And that's why the cap rate is higher. So you might see the 8% cap rate, which means that for every $100 that you spend, each year you're getting back $8. Mm-hmm. In an area like we're on right now, the cap rate could be 5%. Mm-hmm. So you're only making $5.
So it's in the owner's interest that poor neighborhoods stay poor.
That's a good question. I think that an owner doesn't want a neighborhood to stay poor, because if the property belongs to that owner, then they also want to take advantage of the leverage appreciation. So if they're borrowing money to buy that, they want that property to increase in value, because the overall return, you have to factor in the leverage appreciation. And not just the positive leverage when you're borrowing a certain amount at a certain percentage and comparing that with the cap rate. I think we just lost the audience with that.
Yeah, I think what you're saying. I think what you're saying is it depends if the owner wants to sell the property at some point. And I think it's interesting, because what you see in these neighborhoods, and especially the depressed ones, is that they're filled with owners who are just sitting on these properties forever. You know, they're owning them, they're passing them down to their kids, or the kids are fighting over probate for these properties. A lot of those buildings, you know, may be vacant as well, but that's not part of what we're discussing here. But I think you do find a lot of owners who are there for the long run and don't seem to be interested in selling until there's a gentrification cycle. And then even then, you always get these holdouts who don't want to improve the property or sell. And yeah, it makes sense, because they're cash cows.
They're cash cows. Well, yeah, I don't think that there's a conspiracy with owners to want to keep people poor. But I do believe that there's always a segment of society that will be poor, and hence they have to live somewhere, and hence there will be investors willing to invest in those areas.
Right, and people who don't have money, I mean, it's there's money in poverty. Is, you know, there's just no other way around it.
There's money in poverty. There is, of course. But yeah. I think that since rent is something that they have to pay because housing is an essential human need,
right,
then money will come from those places. And in my opinion, if you're going to invest anyway, you should look at areas that you get a higher return on your money, since they're paying the rents anyway.
Were you seeing these big margins in other West Coast cities? Like, was it a universal, or were people like, wow, Portland in particular, like you said, was undervalued?
No, I think gentrification happened all over the country. I know in New York, our brownstone was $42,000 back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. So were you aware of other hot markets at the time? Because we're not talking about 30-year increase in value. We're just talking about one 18-month increase in value. Or was there a sense that the Portland market is hot?
We have a lot of capital migration coming in from different states and from different countries like Asia, like countries in Asia. But for the most part, it's local. It's commercial real estate. It's multifamily commercial real estate is fairly local. So a lot of the investors are here to begin with, and a lot of them don't necessarily invest in properties that they cannot drive to.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the mom and pops in this area, they live in this area. So this is where they're going to invest in. So I think looking at other markets, maybe some of the larger companies that can take advantage of different markets would do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the vast majority of the landlords here live in the area.
Like, what percentage is being driven by investment outside of the local market?
I guess it depends on what report you read. I've seen as high as 40% of the buildings here, the money coming in from out of state or out of the country, but I don't think it's that high. So probably 20 to 40% at most.
Today, some people are saying the market has slowed down. Mm. Where are we at in terms of the market in your view?
Well, the market has slowed down, but it's still growing. So we still have about 12,000 apartment units that are being built right now. So there's still a lot of construction. I know that before the inclusionary zoning, now in 2017, there were 10,300 permits for units. And in 2018, it slowed down, but not by much. It slowed down by about 3,000 units.
Mm-hmm.
So
you get about 10,000 units permitted each year.
So in 2018, there's now 7,300 new permits for new construction.
Right.
So with that said, it's still bullish.
Mm-hmm.
The market, the investors still bullish. However, it's slowed down a little bit, but it's still growing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we still have a lot to go in Portland.
What neighborhoods do you think are growing fastest? Where are investors and developers moving in?
Well, obviously we have to look at the definition of what's close in Portland. How do you define close in, Adam, in your view?
I think close in, I mean, it's generally like from the bottom of the West Hills, right, out to the 82nd Avenue, up to the Columbia River, and then down to Selwood is kind of like the Republic of Portland. You know, that's traditionally been, you know, as close in as 39th,
right,
is close in. But now that definition is, you know, if you're west of 82nd, people still recognize that as being inside the cool part of Portland.
Yeah. See, it's funny because if I ask another person, I'll get a definition of what different definition of close in. I see close in as walking distance from the center of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's still a lot of investment close in.
Mm-hmm.
So up to 39th. Actually, there's new construction all the way up to 50th if you go on Hawthorne. So I think that the market is still hot, close in, but it's less so as you go out from the city. So there's few development in Gresham, for instance, but you're seeing a lot in the Southeast.
And then Lentz and places where there's been high rates of home appreciation, has there been much, you know, new residential speculation for multifamily?
I've seen less there. It's kind of strange to look at the correlation, because if you look at Troutdale, they have some of the lowest vacancy rates right now, but you're not seeing a lot of investors there. You're seeing more in maybe downtown, where there's high vacancy, up to 6%. So it's a bizarre correlation.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that. You know, in July, Oregon Business Magazine reported that there were 16,000 vacant units in Portland apartments, at a time in which there was still, many consider, a rent crisis going on.
Yeah.
Why are those units vacant?
So I actually read that article. It was Linda Baker, I believe, and she issued an erratum on that, because that 16,000 is based on approximately 5% vacancy of all the units available. So statistically, when you evaluate a property, we usually say 5% vacancy, because it's hard to argue with 5%.
That vacancy rate fluctuates. Right,
it always fluctuates
in the marketplace, not in the building.
Right.
In the marketplace,
so
an investor will see there's a 3% vacancy rate in Portland, therefore, and rents are going up. Therefore, there's room to grow. There's room for me and time for me to buy a building, and increase the rent or build a building from scratch. Right.
Sure. We're still seeing that, so we're still seeing growth in the city. The vacancy rate as a whole in Portland is below 5% right now.
Okay.
So it's something like 4.4%.
So there's sort of a myth out there about I don't know if it's a myth, but let me ask you actually, if it's why buildings remain vacant. A lot of people, through anecdotal, you know, evidence, see buildings that are vacant for a long time, brand new buildings, and it perplexes them why a building that's brand new would be empty.
Right.
And there's lots of theories. Why do you think a building would remain empty for a long time when the vacancy rate in the market is below 4%, according to certain real estate investment brokers?
Well, it's generally the market that determines what the rent should be. So if the Yard, for instance, is offering apartment dwelling units for $4,500 a month, a lot of people can't afford to pay that, so they're not going to live there. And that's why the vacancy rate there was so high, is because you just simply cannot live there. I toured a property there, and I know I can't afford to live there.
Right, but it remains empty, right?
So it remains empty, and you don't necessarily want to diminish the brand. So in business, you have a thing called goodwill, right? And it's kind of like the J. Crew example. So J. Crew's goodwill used to be very high because they offered products that were expensive, and it sold to a certain type of person. But then over the last few years, it's at the verge of bankruptcy because they started to offer all of these sales. So now something that costs $200, it's in a discount rack for $49 with an additional 20% off. And because of that, then people started to get used to paying the lower prices. So if you take that example and you look at buildings, why would you want to live at a building for $2,000 a month when you know when other people in there have paid lower than that, because the goodwill of the building goes down.
So, but you can always raise the rent. I mean, that's what happens all the time.
Rents rarely
go down.
They do, but there could also be something in a construction loan, for instance, that says that a rent has to be a certain amount.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on the terms and conditions of the contract when building that building.
So what will a developer do if they can't? So there's a fallacy here, which is the market fallacy, which is that the market is organic and not simply a product of the regulatory environment. That's I think is a fallacy. And then the second is that supply and demand actually adjust prices, and that they're, you know, and that if supply goes up, prices will go down. So what we're running into there is a market fallacy. Like, there could be an oversupply of housing, but prices will not go down. At least in many cases, prices will not go down.
Well, I think for the most part, it sticks to market principles. But I think that if you look at these Class A brand new buildings, you might see them not renting it out to not lower the goodwill of the building. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, if you look at the overall market, it does follow the market. Mm. And I think that you're seeing concessions in 8% of the buildings, and the vast majority of them are these brand new buildings because they have to do that.
I think the city did analysis, maybe it was CoStar, that said 80% of the new construction was 4- and 5-star sort of rated buildings in terms of quality and price. So again, that's the tough part of supply and demand, is if the only supply that's getting built is for the top of the market.
It takes
years for that to trickle down.
Well, you have to start a building, you have to start it at a Class A in many ways, because as it becomes older and becomes dated, then it becomes a Class B and then a Class C. So unless you do a renovation. So you kind of want to build for the high end, but then it becomes lower and lower in terms of being desirable.
So the idea that supply and demand will take care of, say, a rent crisis, seems to be another fallacy, because supply and demand does take effect. It does work, but it takes a long time for it to work. So, you know, the idea that we'll add more buildings, but they're all going to be high-end buildings, there's a ratchet effect. It's sort of in play. And, you know, even if we have a ton of big buildings, expensive buildings, we're not going to lower the rent right away.
Yeah.
And when those buildings become 100 years old, it'll be very affordable to people. So that really doesn't help people within the lifespan of a normal human. So then you get rent regulations, and that's an organic response to a regulatory environment that produces these iniquities. So now we have the relocation fee, which means landlords have to pay to relocate their tenants if they raise the rent or evict without cause. They raise the rent significantly above 10%. Do you see that that's had an effect in the market? Has that changed anything?
You know, it's kind of, well, what Cornelius is talking about is if you evict someone for no cause, or if you change the terms and conditions of a contract so that the tenant is forced to move, then for studio, the landlord would have to pay $2,900 all the way up to $4,500 to relocate someone for a 3-bedroom plus. But in reality, a lot of landlords do not raise rent over 10%. If someone is evicted because rent is raised 10% or higher, then it would be subject to these rules. But in reality, a lot of rent increases are not that high, so it doesn't affect the vast majority of the properties. And also, I think that it would be adversarial. It would have to basically go to court for the landlord to pay that amount to a tenant who is forced to move out.
They just have to be notified. The tenant does have to trigger it, but they just trigger a written notice, and then they're legally obligated to pay that.
They do, but a landlord will come up with a cause. There's probably a cause, so they're not just going to...
A cause for rent increase?
A cause to evict someone. Or so instead of relying on just saying, hey, I'm kicking you out for no reason, they're going to come up with a reason. And I think that's what will happen. But in reality, have you seen many cases where a landlord has had to pay these?
The LA Times, Thatcher, who was on this show, Thatcher Schmidt, who was on this show just recently, did an article for the LA Times, said there's only three actual payouts. There have been hundreds of requests, though.
There you go.
So
with that said, I don't think it has affected the it hasn't affected investors very much at this point because it would have to be an adversarial process.
Okay.
And what person who can't afford rent can afford a lawyer?
And what about the what do you think would be the impact of proposed rent control? If rent control came into Portland, say, at 8%?
Well, I think that right now, so we take an example like inclusionary zoning, which is essentially rent control already, right? City says that if you build more than 20 units, then you have to include 20%, up to 20% of the units.
That's correct.
That is for people who earn 80% of the median income.
Right, you're saying so they can't charge more.
Like per
capita. That is rent control. Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
but if you do the math, right? And this is funny, like if you look at the median income for a family in Portland, it's around 69,000, just slightly less. What's 80% of that? Around 55,000, right? You take 55,000, you divide it by 40, that comes out to about $1,375 for the rent that the landlord has to charge for that low-income family. $1,375 is pretty close to market rent, you see?
Yeah, I think, and that's been the criticism of IZ, inclusionary zoning, is that the MFI is too high. It doesn't really penetrate down into real poverty.
It sounds like it's helping, but it's really the rent that comes out of it is still pretty much market rent.
But you view it as rent control. So what if there was a rent control? You couldn't increase the rent for more than 8% a year until that person moved out.
I think that, first of all, I don't think that's going to happen, because we've already had the large rent increases. So by the time the government tried to have some intervention, the rent is pretty close, it's already at market rent. So you're not gonna increase it higher than maybe 3-4% per year. I don't think it's gonna go up anyway. So if you're gonna regulate how much it can go up, you know, I think what you're gonna do is you're gonna probably affect more of the smaller investors more. And by virtue of that, you might have some consolidation. Maybe they can't afford to be in a business anymore, and they'll sell to these larger companies. So I think at the end of the day, the people with less money, including the investors, will suffer from any rent control.
Do you think that such a rent control would cause landlords always say, well, if you put rent control in, people won't maintain their buildings and they'll just fall into disrepair and, you know, next thing you know, South Bronx.
That's a possibility. So if they have to come, they have to make certain numbers, because a building is a business. So if it has to come out from somewhere, so if you're not going to renovate as often, if you're going to lower some of the services, then you may have to do that. But the money has to come from somewhere. So that could be a factor.
Do you think if Oregon adopted a just cause eviction law, that would change the market?
You mean if you have to give a cause?
Yeah.
Well, essentially that's what we have now.
Well, we have no cause eviction. I don't, you know, you don't have to give any reason.
Well, We do, but then you'd have to pay the relocation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in effect that's what we have, or else they pay a fine. Mm-hmm. And you know, landlord doesn't want to go to court either, because if they lose, then they have to pay that amount plus three times the rent. Mm-hmm. Plus attorney's fees. So who wants to pay that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think in effect there's cause, there's eviction, but only through cause from that.
Do you think
that rule alone?
All right. Well, Rue, we really appreciate your time, and it's been really enlightening, and thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And welcome back into Priced Out, the podcast. Once again, you're here with Andrew Morgan and Cornelius Swart. Great interview with Rue. Where'd you find Rue at, man?
So where did I find Rue? Rue actually approached me because he'd heard about the film, and we spent a long time together working on an article that he was going to write for a magazine for Norris Stevens, which is an investment firm here in Portland that owns a lot of multifamily properties, and they put out an annual magazine to their clients every year, and we had a long Q&A about gentrification, and basically they didn't put out a magazine this year, so it never went public, and so I think he's shopping the article around, and I just thought he was an interesting guy as a result, and we just said, well, you interviewed me, let me interview you, and so we returned the favor.
All right, so guys, you always have to remember that the extended version of any of our interviews are on Facebook Live. So
that's right.
You get a chance to see the full 53-minute interview, and it's a lot of information involved. It's really great. So if you really want to dive in a lot deeper, as you put it last week, if you have a hankering for more of this, we definitely want to make sure that you know that that's provided for you.
A hankering for more. There's a big steamy scoop on your plate ready on Facebook Live.
Yes,
steamy scoop.
All right, so we will see you guys next time on Priced Out, the podcast.